So Tariq suggested we might, maybe people have some questions. Do you want a stool, or are you okay?
I'm happy, yeah.
Okay, maybe another discussion. I'll turn up the lights.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just wondering, with the close link between poetry and politics in the Middle East and particularly the Arab world, do you foresee there being any possibility in perhaps any of those countries of a poet perhaps achieving some sort of political power, like Václav Havel, for example, did in Czechoslovakia?
Václav Havel wasn't a poet.
Really?
No, he was a playwright. But I don't think, when I look at the poets of the Arab world, they are people who, protect their independence. They're very fierce about protecting their independence. And so for them, even politicians who they feel quite fond of, are still, they like keeping a distance from them. I can't think of a poet coming to power in the Arab world. I really can't see it. It doesn't make sense at all. Even if you had a totally democratic elections in that world, the poets wouldn't stand. It's just that's the tradition. And it was the same in Pakistan. Some of the top poets were offered by the government, would you like to become a senator in the upper house? And they said, no, thank you. It's very sweet of you to think about us, but we'd rather not.
Yeah.
Do you think that one of the reasons why a lot of this poetry that you just mentioned from Pakistan and the Arab world, the reason it's not translated, particularly in this country, has to do precisely with the fact that this publishers in this country associate poetry from other parts of the world with politics, and there's a particular analogy for politics here. Association of art and politics. I'm from Pakistan too, I know precisely from the things you're talking about. And the second issue is related to this, last year there was a report published by the UN, the Arab Human Development Report, which said that one of the reasons the Arabs were still not somehow quite where they should be culturally, politically, was because they were not translating literatures from other parts of the world. And then I did some research, and it was all over Harper's Magazine. I wanted to find out how many translations were published in this country, not including scientific papers and what have you. There were a total of 40 books published here. So, and this shows you, what people like Vernon Lewis and others basically continue to say. So, do you think that has something to do with the fact that in order to publish the poets from Iraq or the poets from Pakistan, you would have to somehow sanitize the poetry? Or what would have to happen?
Well, I don't think it's as conscious as that, to tell you the truth. Basically, English has become the imperial language par excellence now. Everyone wants to be translated into English, including the French, who never used to. Who were very proud of that. They are desperate now to be translated into English because they know unless you are translated into English, the empire doesn't even read you. So it's not just the Arab language that suffers as a result, or Turkish, or any of these other languages which produce, very fine works in fiction and non-fiction. It applies to large parts of the world. If the truth be told, very few of the native writers writing in Indian languages are translated into English. And this is part of the parochialism that has swept the Western world since the advent of what is known as globalization. The globalization, which has permitted capital to take the world, has also made the world very parochial, not just in terms of not translating or not being interested in other countries, but not even reporting what's going on in those countries until there's a crisis. So I don't think it's just to do with the fact that some of these poems are political. I'd be very happy if Nizar Kabani's non-political poems were translated. His love poetry. It's not that Saadi Yusuf has been translated by a small publishing house in the United States. Fayez has been translated. Agha Shahid Ali translated some of his poems, and they were published by tiny houses in the States. The problem with poetry is that it's by and large not recognized by big publishing houses as a popular form. So you'll see that some of the best publishing houses in terms of poetry are very small publishing houses, and they produce very, very fine poetry. So there's a general problem with poetry. Then the second problem you get, which I think all of you are aware of, is translation. It is incredibly difficult to translate poetry, you know, from any other language into English. It can be done, and some of these translations I've read are good. But I know that on The Jackal's Wedding, there were four translators with Saadi Yusuf working on the translation before they agreed a version which could be published in my book. And, you know, we had to really struggle over it. So it's not easy. This especially applies to some of the poetry of that other country, which we haven't discussed, where poetry played a very big role, which was Russia. I mean, the poetry of Mandelstam and Akhmatova was very difficult to translate. Some very fine translations have been done, but if you just compare all the different translations of the same poem, most of them are rubbish. And the Russians always say that the reason the West can't understand Pushkin is because they can't, they've never been able to translate him properly into the English language. So there is a general problem. But I agree with you, obviously, on Bernard Lewis and the stereotypes that exist of Arab culture. I mean, this applies also to fiction. I mean, one of the finest novelists in the Arab world, writing at the moment, I mean, apart from Mahfouz, who's known because he's got the Nobel Prize, but, you know, not every novelist can get a Nobel Prize. But Abdurrahman Munif, a Saudi novelist, who wrote this incredible series of novels, which on Saudi Arabia, and was deprived of his Saudi nationality as a result. You'd have thought that given the big interest in Saudi Arabia at the moment, they'd be putting them in paperback. I think Random House or Knopf translated the first three, never put them in paperback. And the next, there are five novels in all. And if I always advise people, if you want to understand the history of Saudi Arabia, read Munif. You will understand it better than from any non-fiction book. Sometimes this can happen. But he's not available any longer. That's the problem. So I think one has to try and make these things available like we make other news from within the Western world, which is not widely publicized, available. We have to find alternative means of doing it. Yeah.
You mentioned Umm Kulthum, who's a wonderful singer, and I'm only aware of her because I have an Egyptian friend, and there was a movie here in L.A. about her. So it's a discovery. On our radio stations, we do have some world music radio stations, but they actually have rather narrow choices. But I bring her up because I wanted to ask you, in the West, people are interested in women, and someone like Taslima Nazreen was published in the New Yorker. Three or four of her poems were published in the New Yorker, and then she kind of disappeared for the wider reading public. And I don't know what has happened to her. I know that she was threatened, her life was threatened. She was a Pakistani woman poet.
A Bangladeshi. Yeah.
But I wanted to ask you, what role are women playing? Are they poetry? Or I know that Umm Kulthum was certainly active in that way, that she sang a political poem. But how much voice do women have in these issues?
Well, I mean, Umm Kulthum was singing Arab in the Arab world. You had many big women singers in Pakistan, a Muslim state, who were singing the poetry of Fayez and other poets. And one of the sort of best-known poems of Fayez, who's the greatest Pakistani poet, was made completely popular when it was sung by Noor Jahan, one of the great singers of that country. So this is something which does happen, that a great poem is often, or quite often, immediately transformed into a song. Someone composes the music, and it's sung, just like, you know, in the old days, the great composers used to compose music for the great poets of Europe. It used to happen. That carries on being done today, and that culture is by no means over. And as far as women poets are concerned, there are quite a few in the Arab world and in Pakistan. There's a good collection, actually, of poetry by men and women. I'm trying to remember. It's a university publishing house here which has published it. And they carry on writing, and sometimes they write, I mean, you know, the Fahmida Riaz, a Pakistani poet, writes very courageous poetry, taking on clerical oppression, taking on male oppression. It's very upfront poetry, and it's published, and she recites it and is received very well. Taslima Nasreen is a slightly different story, because there's a big debate about her, not for because of she's attacking religion, but of the literary quality of her work. And many critics in the South have been critical of her from a literary point of view, saying she's only been taken up because she made these attacks on the mullahs. But if you actually read her poetry and her fiction, the quality isn't very good. I happen to agree with that. And that's not, you know, it's not the best reason to take up an author simply because she's attacking religion. One has to have some literary judgment on the quality of the work. But that work hasn't been very big in that part of the world because it's not very good. Whereas others who've been even more critical than her, but not so well known because they haven't been threatened by the clerics, their work proceeds. I mean, in a sort of on a totally different register, you can see, you know, it's a sort of some of the. There's a very vibrant culture in Iran at the moment, very vibrant, both in terms of what's being written, in terms of artists, in terms of conceptual art, in terms of cinema. And if you see some of the cinema coming out of Iran, it is pure poetry. Actually, just the way the movie is shot, you get a feeling without a word being said what the filmmaker is trying to convey. So people are, you know, are doing these things, and it's quite interesting. You know, this is the other comparison I often make, that if you compare the movies coming out of Iran, or you can go further east in a country like Taiwan. These are quite stunning movies compared to what is by and large being produced in the West today. I'm not talking about Hollywood, but, you know, I'm talking about movies being produced by directors who one sort of respects in Europe. I don't think they match what is coming out of that world. Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you a comment about the great exclusion of the Arab cultures and the transmission of knowledges from the ancient world to the Renaissance, and how that whole 500 years have been left out with astronomy, botany, calculus, all of the hygiene, you know, and because all of the stars, you know, they have Arab names, and, you know, and because the Arab and the Chinese were working with astronomy at that time, as opposed to the European. And I wanted to ask you if you could comment on that. Why has that area been left out so much in the history books?
Well, because the dominant history books are written by the victors. Always the case. I mean, I'll give you an example. I mean, in 1992, I wrote my first novel in this series of novels I've been writing since that time, The Islam Quintet. And this was a novel about Islam in Spain, or the decline of that civilization. And this is a civilization which governed and ruled in Spain and Portugal for nearly 500 years. So obviously it left its mark. And so I recovered that world and evoked its decline in this novel. And to my astonishment, when the novel was translated into Spanish, and I mean it was very well received, but when I went on a tour, large numbers of Spanish people said that they had no idea. They said, we thought it was just a few places in the south, i.e. the places where there are still ruins, Granada, Cordoba, Sevilla. I said, no, it was the whole peninsula, including Galicia. And that they shook them. But they said, Galicia was never Muslim. I said, no, it wasn't Muslim, because there weren't many forced conversions. But it was part of Arab culture. And in the course of writing that novel, I'd uncovered a little scholarly work in a library which said that the Galician monastery, the papers of a Galician monastery in a remote part of Spain, had been discovered. And the monastery was, you know, destroyed ages ago. But the names of the monks and the abbots were still there in these books. The language they were written in was Arabic. That's not surprising, because that was the language of that peninsula. But the interesting thing was that the names of all these Christian monks were what? Muhammad, Ahmad, Hussein, etc. In other words, the culture had taken over, but had not imposed the religion. And that, when I told some of my Spanish readers that, they were completely stunned. And this goes very deep in Spain, to answer your question, of not remembering, of forgetting the past, forgetting the history. Because what they did in the 15th century was horrific. They threw out, expelled all the Muslims and the Jews from that peninsula. Either you leave or you convert to Christianity. And of course, many who didn't want to leave did convert. And then the Inquisition used to spy on them, because Muslims cleaned themselves 5 times a day and had lots of baths, especially before they said their prayers. Spies of the Inquisition used to go around seeing in houses of conversos whether they were still having baths or not. So to be a Christian meant you had to stink. And for instance, the Jews in Mallorca who were goldsmiths and silversmiths and didn't want to, you know, convert it, just to show that they had converted, they would sit outside their shops on the Jewish Sabbath and eat pork, just to convince the Inquisition that, look, we are genuine converts. I mean, it's to that extent, that's how the European identity was formed. And that formed the identity of the people who then came and conquered North and South America as well, and came there. So there is that link and relationship between these two. But now these things are at least being discussed. I mean, the other interesting thing about forgetting history is that to this day there exists a big debate in the Spanish Academy as to whether Cervantes, the sort of originator of the European novel, whether he was of Jewish origin or not. There's no doubt he was of Jewish origin. He came from a family of Jewish conversos. He applied to go to the New World, but was not allowed, because they at that time were restricting people going to the New World, as it was called, if they had converted just a generation ago. So he was not allowed to go, because his family were two recent converts from Judaism. But then there's another interesting thing in Don Quixote. If you look at the structure of this book, I mean, he doesn't forget where he's coming from, this guy. And the manuscript of Don Quixote is supposedly an Arab manuscript which he found in a bazaar. And if you read the book, it's full of absences. The structure of it is very interesting. Stories within stories within stories within stories. The old tradition of Arab storytelling. But then even within that, suddenly, Quixote and Sancho Panza come to a village, and there's no one living in that village anymore. And the modern reader, without the knowledge of why, would think it's just, you know, who knows, it's people have left. But at the time he was writing, everyone knew who those people were who'd left. It was either a Muslim village or a joint Muslim-Jewish village. And the point I always make, especially when I'm talking and debating with Israelis today, is that historically the relations between Judaism and Islam were pretty good. Many of the Jews expelled from Spain, where did they go? They went to the Ottoman Empire, to Istanbul, where they were given refuge by the sultans. So it's very important to be aware of history, but one isn't. But it's extremely important to recover it, and it's now, it is slowly. There is a way in which this history is being rediscovered. And of course, you know, all serious scholars will tell you that without Islamic civilization, the writings and texts of the ancient world would not have been synthesized and passed on to the Latin world, which finally fired the Renaissance. No one denies this anymore. I mean, only very ignorant people do, but no scholar will deny that. It's not known, I don't think, Bush and Ashcroft are aware of this fact. I wouldn't worry too much about it.
I was wondering if you could expand a little bit on the oral tradition of storytelling and poetry, particularly in Iraq, given that, you know, our propaganda mills and the Pentagon are feeding us this Americanization of Iraq is going on, particularly in the new schools opening up. What impact do you see that will have on oral tradition in general, if any?
Well, it's not just the oral tradition, it's the whole culture and tradition of that country. I mean, the one thing, this Saddam Hussein did horrible things, but under the Ba'athists, a lot of good things were done too. I mean, Iraq had the highest level of literacy in the Arab world. Large numbers of women were trained as doctors, teachers, technicians, pilots. Women were not treated as second-class citizens in the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s in Iraq. It had a very, very efficient health service where treatment was free for everyone. Whoever you were, you had free medical treatment in Iraq, which is a much more advanced system than you have in this country. This is all being dismantled now. If it was just the oral cultural traditions which they were trampling on, we would be very angry, naturally. But it's not just that. That's, you know, a sideshow. What is being destroyed is all that which was made available to the Iraqi population, and they are introducing, basically making Iraq as if it was one of the states in the United States. That's what is being done, and the result of this is that the health and education of the people will suffer. It will be a tiny elite which will get all the goodies and will receive education and health. Otherwise, you know, people who can't afford it won't get it, and that's one reason which is causing all the anger as well, because people know that. Yeah?
I'm going to add one comment and a question. That, you know, poetry written in English doesn't have a big audience here in the United States. You know, I mean, in regard to talking about an audience for translated poetry, I mean, poetry is just kind of remains for a very small amount of people. And I did, since I'm a filmmaker, want to comment on your remark about, you know, more poetic film coming from Taiwan or the East is also connected to the problem of capital here, because the more poetic filmmakers are not supported in this country, and their work is just very difficult to see it and make it. Anyway, that was a comment. But my question is that when you spoke, you said that there are things going on in Baghdad and Basra that even those of us who are here, who are hopefully slightly on the educated side, don't know. what's going on. Could you just tell us some things that we might not know?
Large-scale arrests, tortures, killings, destruction of people's homes, classic colonial operation. That's what's going on, which is not reported in the press, but is reported in sections of the Arab press. And this, if this was reported in on the American networks and in the American media, people would refuse to go and sell it there. And the people who know what's going on better than anyone else are American soldiers.
And we don't hear from them.
Well, you don't. I mean, it's not totally true that you don't, because soldiers have been on furlough here. Some have been interviewed, and they've come up with amazing stuff, actually. Much better than the journalists supposed to be covering the war. I mean, I've read a long interview with a sergeant who was a Latino sergeant, who was back here, and he gave a long interview to the New York Times, which was just amazing.
But
he said it's a falling war. We were told we were going to liberate a people, and the people look at us, ordinary people of every type, look at us with bitterness and anger in their eyes, and this is very difficult to take. Mm-hmm. And one of the figures we've got, which I haven't had confirmed, but evidently it'll come out sooner or later, that 6,000 soldiers have come back because of mental health problems.
Yeah.
Is that come out already?
Yes.
Yeah.
Starting.
Okay. And you know, people have had nervous breakdowns.
But people who have spoken out, as you said, who are members of the armed forces, have also been court-martialed.
Yeah.
For being unpatriotic.
This guy hadn't been. Guy who was in the New York Times, but he may be. No, but I mean, there's a limit to what they can do. Because, you know, they sent these soldiers in with one thing in their heads: you'll be greeted and welcomed as liberators. And when that didn't happen, they were certainly shocked because they believed it. You know, I mean, they shouldn't have believed it. And the other big problem they face is that if they carry on like this and decide to hang on to Iraq indefinitely, they'll have to introduce the craft. Can't do it without that, because the poor kids will stop joining the army. They don't join the army to go and kill. They join it because it's a job, or because they've been promised that they'll be put through school, etc., etc. Once they realize they're going there, they're going to kill, it will tail off, and then they'll have to introduce the craft. I mean, what they're trying to do isn't working, which is using the Eastern Europeans. And the Eastern Europeans, who were once labeled as the satellite states of the Soviet Union, have just as easily become the satellite states of the United States. I mean, there are Poles and Bulgarians and Ukrainian soldiers in Iraq. What the hell are they doing there? So that's not going to work. And I'm told when there's a big riot in Najaf, a holy city in southern Iraq, the Eastern European soldiers refused to come out of their barracks to quell it because they were scared. Well, I don't blame them. But they shouldn't be there in the first place. Okay.
Thank you.